opened, and why these particular objectives seem to be in order. The first one, quote, "The union exists to make the large university a more human place." Well, this derived partly from President Glenn Frank's statement as we got ready to open the union, this rather bell-ringing phrase, "The union is a living room which converts the university from a house of learning into a home of learning." This has been an oft-quoted statement by Frank. And then, of course, it goes back to the original Van Hise inaugural, in which he said, "Nothing that the professor or laboratory can do for the student can take the place of daily close companionship with hundreds of his fellows." You see, Van Hise was recognizing, even at the turn of the century, and this got more and more severe as the years passed, that the older humanizing, personalizing elements of university life were disappearing. The boarding house, the chapel, the personal relations with faculty, all of which were feasible and possible with a small enrollment, but which time dissolved. All these had tended to drop out of the picture, so one of the purposes now of the union we identified was to restore the personality and the humaneness of the university. And we actually had some deliberate action in this direction, such as the union never closed except for one or two days a year throughout the year, even when university was in recess, because we felt that with the students who were stuck on the campus and lonely, it was more important than ever to have this kind of facility open as a headquarters for dining, for finding each other, for social purposes, for recreation, and so on. So we made a fetish, you might say, of extending what we had to offer to students however and whenever we could. There came the bank holiday in 29, and the banks closed. Maybe you remember the great bank holiday. Students couldn't cash a check. We, with Dean Goodnight, by the way, set up an office in my office to issue script to students during the bank holiday who didn't have any money, any cash, so that they could buy meals and keep themselves going until they got some money from home or the banks reopened. We come to the Christmas holidays, for example, and we'd have on Christmas Eve a party for the stay-at-homes. For 10 or 12 years, I never was able to spend Christmas Eve at my own home. I, with other members of our staff, were always here at the union through Christmas Eve, feeling that this was important for the student who had no home here, only a rooming house room. And so there was a whole evening of music, dancing, games, refreshments, talk, and with the union staff playing host and hostess to this group. And this group usually meant a lot of foreign students who were at ill at ease and at sea on where to go and what to do during the two-week Christmas break. Same with graduate students who lived far away and or had to stay here to finish a thesis or whatever. And the same thing would happen on New Year's Eve, for example. During the war, come New Year's Eve, when there's a couple thousand trainees on the campus, how do they celebrate New Year's Eve? On a campus far from home, nobody else around but them, so on. So we set forth and booked Duke Ellington's band for an evening show in the theater on New Year's Eve, and everybody has a ball. So there was indeed some carrying out of this objective of making the university a more human, I might even say humane, place. Well, this was one objective. The second was to provide the facilities where students and teachers may naturally come together. And you would recognize this problem knowing what it takes for a faculty man to invite students to his home far away in Madison. He can't find them, they can't find him, and it's a difficult thing to arrange on the part of all parties. So all sorts of efforts were made here at the Union to facilitate the coming together of students and faculty on a out-of-class, informal basis. Coffee hours, often the hostesses behind the table were faculty wives, and we had a coffee hour every Friday afternoon in the main lounge, and we took departments in rotation, and all the students of a given department, like history, say, were invited to come on that day because the history faculty would be there.
Oh, I see.
They would have a chance to meet them informally. Then we had what was called Dinner with Professor X, where students could sign up, 20 or 25 maximum, on a Sunday night to meet in for a Sunday supper in, say, the Beef Eater's Room with a given professor whose name was known to them through the announcement, if they wanted to meet with and know more about Professor Ray Agard. They'd sign up, come for dinner.
Did you find the faculty receptive of
very,
this idea?
Very. And they were particularly receptive when we offered the chance to have one of their class meetings once or twice a semester in the Union Popover Room with coffee on the house served by the Union. This had to be a smallish kind of class, not more than, say, 30 or 35. But when the faculty man or woman saw that he'd like to vary the pace, he'd like to get to know his students better, and saw the importance of their seeing him or her in a different light, he would call up the Union and arrange for this room, say, at 10 o'clock on a Thursday morning. And everybody, all the class members would come in, and he'd run his class through as usual, but there was coffee on the table for everyone. And there was a fine response to this by the faculty, who saw the importance of the humanitarian relationship. Well, this objective was summed up by another phrase in this pamphlet in terms of a place where personal relations may naturally find expression, and the union provide a comprehensive and well-considered program for the social life of the university. Now, this was back in 1930, but you'll find that this phrase runs through our literature and now is the lead statement of the International Association of College Unions stated objective for a union. A union exists to provide a comprehensive and well-considered program for the community life of the university. It says social life here because we weren't yet aware of the community center concept. I'll come to that in a moment. And this partly grew out of a report of the Faculty Committee on the Curriculum, which said, "It's apparent from the purpose and history of American higher education that the curriculum is but one of the problems essentially involved. For a complete adjustment to changed conditions, there would be necessary a re-examination of and a program for the social life of the college." So you see, this came partly out of our desperate attempts to find out through reading what we could do that was useful and important. So, a comprehensive, well-considered program for the social life of the university, objective number two. And number three was, the union stands as the university's recognition of the importance of the leisure hour. We were in the era when the 40-hour week was just coming in instead of 48 or 54 hours. There was vast unemployment with people completely at leisure. There was growing evidence in the press and in thoughtful books and treatises of the importance socially in our American society of how people were going to employ their leisure, this newly found leisure time. Would it be idle, wasteful time? Would it be destructive? Would it be constructive? Would it add anything to the self-development of the people involved? And translated into university terms, this is something we thought we'd better find out about. Do students have any leisure time, and what do they do with it? So we undertook, at about this time, a comprehensive study called Student Use of Leisure Time at the University of Wisconsin. It's a thick, black-bound book, 300 and some pages, made possible partly by student help financed by the federal government under what was then called WPA, kind of a work-study program for students. And there were personal interviews with some 700 or 800 students randomly selected according to a statistically valid plan to find out what they did each day, each week, and so on. Well, that's a long story, but the upshot of it was that it was plain that students were spending more time at ease in leisure pursuits than they were in classes and study put together.
Mm.
Something like 6 to 7 hours a day went into leisure pursuits, and this did not include personal things like dining or brushing your teeth or shopping. It had to do with what do they do when they aren't working, not eating, and so on. And study went on to identify what did students do with the 6 or 7 hours a day. And the alarming evidence was that most of it went into incidental, unproductive pursuits like card playing or listening to the radio or what we used to call bull sessions, but very little positive, active, recreational use of that time in terms of sports, cultural interests, very low. Religious activity, very low. Club and group activity, very low. So on and so on. So, knowing the hopes of the university, which is to create a whole student and one who is making use of his newfound education to improve his lot in life and his breadth of interests and become a better citizen and so on, we thought was, but finding that nobody was doing anything about it.
That is interesting.
That after the class ball, after the classroom bell ring, the faculty member goes home to tend his garden, and the students on the town. So we are talking here about the philosophy of how does a man or woman spend leisure time. We know how significant is the answer to society and the individual. Until very recently, the solution of what to do with all those extra hours rested with commercial amusements or strong personal interests, which hopefully, but not necessarily, the educational process has inspired. Now the students themselves, with the university's approval and help, propose to create to the medium of an organization and clubhouse with the union for a name, create first the physical facilities for enjoying leisure time and second a social and cultural program. Aimed at making leisure as satisfactory and as productive as possible. The hope is that here in the Union, every student may be shown old and new ways of making the best use of his non-working hours. For instance, a student should find in the Union, in the concerts, art exhibitions, library, and discussion groups, the opportunities to manifest, take pleasure in, and make a matter of habit, the cultural interests which the university so painstakingly sets out to cultivate in the classroom, but hadn't done anything about, we found, and so could the union do something? Well, the fourth objective is set out as the union is a genuine student cooperative enterprise aiming to give students experience in governing and managing their own affairs and the opportunity of reducing their living costs. You see, we're in a depression. Mm-hmm. And the economic impact of the union, we thought, could be very important, because the union dining rooms serving students and faculty in effect did set a standard of cost for the whole university area. The State Street restaurant people and others would come looking at our menu boards and our prices in order to set their own, in order to be competitive. They didn't like it, as we discussed to the reference to the complaints and the court suits. But we felt that this was our role to play, to be of economic benefit to students in particular. And so in the early 30s, and starting about the time this objective pamphlet on objective was written, we were serving cafeteria noon specials at 24 cents and showing the possibilities through using specials for breakfast, lunch, and dinner adding up to not more than 73 cents a day. And deliberately so. We were not making any money. In fact, we were losing money on it, but we wanted to keep students in school. This again was part of the earlier number one purpose of helping to make the university a more human place. And so wherever we could, we kept prices for doing things at a low minimum. And most of our programs and services were free. And free in the sense that there were no use charges. The reasoning was a student has paid, and couldn't avoid paying, $10 a year, $5 a semester, to be a member of the union. And that's how we survived financially. It was our main source of income. For this membership fee of $5 a semester, he's entitled to get something that he recognizes as a benefit of membership, and not just paper towels in the washroom or soap. So, well, as one clear-cut example, there have never been any charges to use telephones in the union. We persuaded the telephone company that this is a private club serving its members, and we may offer them toll-free phone service if we wish to. And the phone company didn't particularly like it, but they accepted it. So we've got something still like 15 or 20 telephones in this building, and it doesn't cost a dime, it doesn't cost a penny to use them unless you make a long distance call. And for that we have coin phones or operator controlled phones. Well, this happened day one, and it's still happening in 1979, that any amenities or services that we can offer that help students economically and add up to conveniences that he recognizes as a benefit of his membership and participation in the union, we will do. At least this has been my own personal philosophy about it, and shared by the governing board as long as I was director. Now, in the process of doing this and becoming a cooperative enterprise, in effect the largest student co-op that ever happened around the university, you know, there's a lot of talk about the co-op eating places and the co-op grocery stores and the co-op pharmacies and so on, which are non-profit and therefore cheaper. We've had great difficulty having students see this, but it's actually the case that whether technically described in legal terms as a co-op or not, that's in effect what we are. Because all the monies that come in from whatever sources are used to hold down the cost of services and provide free programs. And if there's anything left over at the end of the year, it goes back to students in terms of improved facilities or additional services and so on. Now the engineering of all of this gives us the opportunity to inculcate in students the motivation to want to lead and to enlist him in a leadership experience that stands him well as he goes through the university and out into his own community. He has, by this time, we think, has had the experience of volunteer leadership that makes him a better citizen.
Now you're talking about the members of the various committees, I imagine.
Particularly them, that's right. There are limitations on how far one can go in the cultivation and training of students as leaders. But we've had at times up to 700 students on committees, and this is a pretty full enterprise to get any kind of a message through and training through to that many students. But we try at it, and the main success is with the chairman and sub-chairman that we have the most frequent dealings with and have all sorts of leadership training sessions and orientation and coaching and almost daily consultation with staff members on how to make a success of what you're doing and where at times you're falling down and what can you do about that. This again goes to a basic purpose of almost every college and university in these United States. If you read their catalogs, they say one of the basic purposes of our college is to produce effective citizens or to train students for citizenship participation in the common welfare. And you have only to reach for a shelf of university and college catalogs to find that this refrain occurs over and over and over again. And you would have only to go to those campuses and find out that nobody's doing anything about it, whatever. Except as they hope something is coming out of the formal classroom teaching, which, of course, never talks about citizenship, never talks about volunteer leadership, never talks about your obligation to society. They talk rather about chemical formulas and mathematics and the importance of Ibsen in Norwegian literature. And so it's a little shaky to assume that from his classroom experience, a student is going to become automatically a citizen leader. He may, on his own motion, find his way around and do it, and he may be a more intelligent guy because he's had a university education, but he doesn't get any or much help along the way at the cutting edge of how can I personally make a contribution to my community or to society as a whole, whether politically or in terms of volunteer service with welfare agencies, or organizing a civic music association because he knows how to do it. He did it at the Wisconsin Union. Or accept a position on a board of directors of an art museum and know what he's talking about because he did it at the art gallery at the Union. And the rewarding thing about the Union experience for me throughout the years has been that there's case after case after case where this indeed is the follow-through, does work. We have legislators, three members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, representatives in Congress, heads of institutes concerned with research on how to solve the economic problems of this country, board members of civic organizations by the hundreds. And it isn't just that this that there is this connection, it's that they write back and tell us that it was their Union experience that prompted them, that they're more successful at it than some other people because of the lessons learned at the Union.
That must be a satisfaction.
And we've got a master's thesis done by Ann Minahan when she was on our staff called The College Union and Preparation for Citizenship. She did this through the School of Education. It went out over the School of Education letterhead, had no apparent connection with the Union. And there's a whole series of questions of what did you do in college and what are you doing now in civic affairs and so on, and what had the most influence on you in doing what you're doing in civic or professional or political affairs. And this was a fairly solid research project because she set up a control group of people who had no Union experience at all and were selected by criteria of from high school of about the same size, same major in college, same rural or urban community, their whole set of criteria on which the control group was matched with the group of former Union committee chairman and sub-chairman. And the Union chairman group far exceeded the control group in participation in community affairs and in politics and in welfare work and in professional organizations and so on, far exceeded. And a very high percent of them identified that the beginning of their interest was in their service on a Union committee.
That's very, very interesting.
And the control group couldn't identify even where they were, and many of course were active in civic affairs and political affairs, not nearly as many as the Union group, but some were, but they couldn't identify any particular experience at the on the campus that motivated them in this direction. So these early four objectives set forth in this pamphlet, I suppose you'd call the groundwork that we started from in building our future. But it did change and amplify and grow through the succeeding years.
Would you discuss some of these changes?
Pardon?
Will you discuss some of these changes?
Yes, I think one of our, well, one of them in effect I've earlier mentioned, and that is that a union wasn't just for men's students.
Oh, yes.
It's for men and women students. And the union isn't just for students. It's also for faculty. And the union is also for alumni, former students. In other words, it's a university union, not a student union. One of the greatest aggravations that come my way is this constant reference to our union and to other unions as a student union. They are not student unions. None of them are student unions. They are all campus unions. And this is true even from the beginning. It was never the Oxford Student Union. It was the Oxford Union. And they urgently sought former students to become and stay members of the Oxford Union. And the faculty and the teachers and the dons were all part of the union population. And it was the Cambridge Union. And in this country, it was the Michigan Union.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Wisconsin Union. We changed from Wisconsin Men's Union right away as soon as this building opened and formed a new organization. It's the Wisconsin Union, not a student union. So,
where does the idea of student union come from then?
I think it comes from is probably this, that the press and article writers see the word union, and they know it has something to do with students, and they are the dominant clientele. There's no doubting that. And they need to say what kind of union. And they never quite catch on to the fact that it's possible to be an all-college union. So they fall back on the word student union, and this gets perpetuated and perpetuated in a very unhappy way. I mean, it's not just a matter of disagreement with nomenclature. It hurts. It hurts terribly, because on many campuses, the faculty sing the title student union, and sometimes it's carved in the stone on the front of the building. Or just assume, well, this is not for us.
Mm.
This is for the students. We would be intruders if we went there. So they tend to stay away. And this is a great disservice to students not to have the informal social association with faculty.
Do you feel that happens here?
It hasn't happened as much as some other places. But we're getting, with our rapid turnover of faculty in this last decade, we're getting an increasing problem of making this clear to faculty that it is not a student union, because some of our own university publications, despite our best efforts, still say student union, although we correct it whenever and wherever that ugly term shows its head. I say it's a misnomer because almost every union without exception has meeting rooms for faculty in it. Some of them have housed the faculty club. They almost all of them welcome alumni. They urge alumni to come. They're full of alumni on athletic weekends and class reunion. The alumni office is very often in the union, and they serve through their meeting rooms and dining rooms. They serve the conference groups and institutes and seminars that are coming to the campus. So it's just a terrible misidentification of what the union is all about. And among other things, it leads to this impulse on the part of the dean of students to say, well, if it's a student union, it belongs to me, because I'm in charge of student affairs. And what he forgets is, and what we've succeeded in establishing on the Wisconsin campus, is that it isn't the dean of student affairs who should be saying what adult conferences like the Bankers Institute or a research international convention should inhabit this building, and shouldn't be saying what the faculty privileges at this building should be, or whether alumni can use it or not, and under what circumstances. This is for a board of directors to say that includes alumni and faculty and the president's appointees. So it hurts in this respect, too, that it gives the wrong idea to the administration of where the union belongs in the hierarchy of university departmental organization. It's you know, here at Wisconsin, we do the food service for the Wisconsin Center, which is concerned almost wholly with institutes and adult conferences. Mm-hmm. We do it for Lowell Hall. We do it for the conference center out on the lakeshore. We do it for the university club. We have to care about that. We have to make a success. And there's always the possibility that in a changing dean of students setup, he's not interested in that. He wants to concentrate on his clientele identified as students, period. So we object heartily to this phrase, student union. And in turn, it has something to do with our basic objective, that is, an all-campus union. And it arises partly out of our local experience and partly out of the dedication address at the dedication opening of this building, when J. Bergen Bickerstaff, the head of Hart House, the union at the University of Toronto, made an eloquent statement to the effect that this union will become a unifying force in the total life of the university, and that nothing is more important than to bring the student and his teacher together, and so on. So this phrase, unifying force, implies unification of the several components of a university community, namely students, faculty, staff, alumni, and guests of the university, including parents of students. And again, you'll find in the International Association statement of the role of the union, this phrase, and the union, in the best sense, is a unifying force in the life of the university, and is for the use of not just students, but also faculty, alumni, university guests, and so on. Well,
what other concepts have changed?
We're starting now, we're saying now, we see the union as for all. But I began myself to wonder, what is this like elsewhere in the American society? Is it something unique to a college campus? And knowing that we were involved in recreational activity, I subscribed to all the recreation magazines and so on and so on. And it not too much later became clear that what we were indeed was a community center, like the community centers of cities and villages, starting with the modest ones of the old town meeting hall and on through to the elaborate ones, like at Westchester County in New York, which includes any and all kinds of activity people engage in their non-working hours. Crafts, social occasions, meetings, club meetings, performing arts, pageantry, the whole bit of what do people do when they're not working. They need a focus or a facility for much of this. And the buildings that provide for it elsewhere are called community centers. So we began to think of the union as not just a building on a campus for us, and particularly not just for students, but as a community center.
And for the university community.
For all the members of the university community. And we came to stating it in terms of anything that interests the people of the university in their non-working time is of interest also at the union. And we'll do whatever we can about it in this objective of providing for a comprehensive, well-considered community life for the university. Now, there are all kinds of interests that express themselves in leisure time. Some are mediocre and not too productive, and others are very rewarding, educational, help in self-development. And being at a university, it seemed to us that since the university's reason for existence is to enhance student capabilities and broaden his horizons and to help him see how he can develop best as a person, that we should take whatever leadership we can in inserting in the union the more productive, useful, rewarding kinds of recreation and leisure uses. Something quite different from and over and beyond just sitting indifferently listening to the radio or watching the television or twiddling your thumbs half asleep or whatever, or even over over-exaggerated card playing and so on. Hence, we arrive at an emphasis on the arts, on cultural activity, for one thing. The performing arts, music, theater, ballet, on films, but good films, not the porno stuff, not the cheap stuff. Art, visual arts, hence the art exhibition program, strongly funded and promoted, on doing things yourself, making things yourself, craft shop, strongly funded, made inexpensive and free to students to do what they did in their own home attic or basement workshop, but don't have it. The university, so we provide it.
You provide tools and equipment?
With the tools,
to work
with the materials at hand, at cost. On discussion and interchange of ideas via panel discussions, debate, seminars, and so on. And so there came to be a growing emphasis through the 30s.
Which culminated,
in a sense, in the efforts to build and open the theater wing of the union in 1939, which was the opening date. Prior to the theater opening, however, we were already at work on so-called leisure interests of a cultural impact. In 1931, a graduating student in art education came in to say she'd written her thesis on what a craft shop in a union might be like, and here's the thesis, would I read it? And if I thought well of it, would I appoint her as the director of a new union craft shop?
You didn't have one up to then.
We had none of them. We had none. And upon reading it and relating this to our growing interest in encouraging useful student hobbies and do it yourself, learn more than you knew before kind of efforts, we did ask her to organize and develop the Union Craft Shop. And then a student came in about 33 or 34. He's the head of our gallery committee, and his proposal was that we organize a statewide competitive exhibition in the arts, painting, sculpture, graphics, watercolors, and so on. Well, there was a statewide competitive show at Milwaukee, sponsored by Wisconsin Painters and Sculptors Society, but that didn't prevent us from trying, because we now had a going art exhibition program, and we saw it as a means of relating the union and the university as a whole to the ongoing art life of the state, and in giving an opportunity to our own students and faculty to enter a competitive juried show. This resulted in the creation and establishment of the Wisconsin Salon of Art in 1934, I think it was. And it was a rousing success, but in the process, we found out that nobody had a list of who the Wisconsin artists residing in the state were, and so much of our effort went into developing such a list, and this was part of my own research in doing my graduate thesis on art in Wisconsin. It's one of the things that prompted the interest in doing the thesis in this area, I being, as you know, an art history major. And so by the time 1936 came along, the celebration of the Wisconsin State Territorial Centennial, we had the research in hand, we had the publication of the book, my book on art in Wisconsin, in hand. I was asked to be chairman of the Centennial Art Commission to present a program for in the arts to add to the celebration of the centennial. And this was an exhibition brought in based on our researches and on our experience with the Wisconsin Salon as a major month or 2 month long exhibition.
Where was
of the arts.
Where was the exhibition?
It was held in our Union Gallery, expanded into the main lounge where we erected all sorts of temporary display panels and so on. So we were on our way in emphasizing cultural uses of leisure. We established a music listening room with classical records only, not the jazz of that period, classical records. We established what was called a living issues library in our browsing room, consisting of top books of the year selected by top faculty members as being the most significant books of a given year, and publicized these. And we had book talks by faculty people in the browsing room. And this went on and on, including, of course, the continuing concert series, which was held mostly in the Great Hall under difficulties because there were folding chairs and there were noise interference from the lobby below, and the telephone would ring on the stage in the middle of an aria, and the room, which was not air conditioned, would be pretty warm and uncomfortable in the late spring and so on. And I had another thought on this, if I can catch it for a moment. We initiated a creative writing contest, and in the music listening room, we would provide miniature scores so that students could follow the actual score while listening to a record. And at some points, a faculty member from music school would come in and review the composition and the composer before the record was played. We had in our Trip Commons Sunday evening dinner hour a string trio playing classical and semi-classical music. We had an orchestra of the Viennese waltz variety playing in the Rathskeller, and so on. Well, what I hesitated over before, and which comes back to me now, is that one of the outcomes of these strong thrusts in getting learning values out of class time, and in serving as laboratory and field work resources for many other university departments, came approval by the Regents in 1935 of a proposal to designate the Union as the university's division of social education, as a kind of a counterpart to the division of physical education, which had always been in existence, presenting a program in team sports, intramural activity, coaches to coach students in how to do it, and observing safety requirements as far as intramurals were concerned, and so on. The Union itself never entered this phase of recreation, the organized team sport phase, although we did early on in about 1930 enter the informal outdoor sports.
You're referring to the
phase in terms of establishing the Hoofers as an outing group, which concentrated first on skiing and later embraced canoeing and mountaineering and sailing and horse riding and caving and anything students wish to do outdoors on a personal basis. We did indeed have a ski team, and we asked the physical education department to, if they didn't want to take over the team sport, the ski team, and provide a coach and steer it like they did their other team sports, and they just weren't interested. They couldn't see it. They were too much involved in football and basketball and baseball and the standard ongoing team sports, and skiing wasn't all that popular or prominent in those days anyhow. So in all of these outcomes of new learning experiences for students that vastly amplified their learning inside the classroom, and then were in many ways more memorable and more persuasive to students because they did it because they wanted to do it, and learned along the way something they hadn't known before, or increased a skill that they had started with, but now it got better. In view of all of this, the university regents, upon recommendation first of our faculty members on the Union Governing Board,